my very first briefing as a lieutenant was to a general officer, you know, a general. And my colonel introduced me with a blonde joke. And I thought, you know, that's not exactly the way that I wanted to start this briefing. Right. I really would have liked to have had the opportunity to just be a lieutenant.
From Politico, this is Women Rule, where we bring you real talk with women bosses. I'm Anna Palmer, senior Washington correspondent and co-author of the Politico Playbook. That's Chrissy Houlihan, a first-term congresswoman from Pennsylvania who's already making a splash on Capitol Hill by launching Congress's first-ever caucus for servicewomen and women veterans. Right now, she's one of only four female veterans serving in the House. And she hopes that as more people see that servicewomen can get elected, it'll inspire them to rethink what's possible. Just like her own childhood role model influenced her career path.
I saw Sally Ride, you know, and I saw that she did it. And I saw that she was a physicist and that she went to Stanford. And so I wanted to go to Stanford.
After serving in the Air Force, Houlihan went on to become one of the top executives at the sporting goods company, And One.
Telling your parents that you're leaving the military and going to join a t-shirt company was a little bit of a hard swallow.
Before joining Teach for America,
I taught chemistry at the same time my youngest child was taking chemistry. And so 10 miles away, you know, seeing the tragic difference in the way that we expect to educate kids was an incredible eye-opener. And what I saw was it's impossible to teach a child chemistry if they are reading at the third or fourth grade level.
And now, here's my conversation with Congresswoman Chrissy Houlihan. You've been in the House now for about 5 months. Is it weird to think about yourself as a member of Congress?
It is an out-of-body experience. It's definitely not anything I anticipated that I would be doing at this point in my life, but I'm really grateful to be here. There's a lot more camaraderie than I expected in Congress. I think that there's, you know, 435, as one of my colleagues says, independent contractors, a lot of different people with a lot of different backgrounds who represent different kinds of communities. And so I've been actually really heartened by the camaraderie that I've been able to experience here, not just within my caucus or my party, but also across the aisle, too.
One of the things in your background that jumps out to people is your military service. You are one of only four congresswomen who are veterans. Why did you decide to start an official caucus?
So it was actually one of my staff members, my awesome team, that identified this as a real issue. You know, we did double the number of women who have served in the military in the last Congress. So we are now four from two. And the number of women who have served in the military over the last, you know, since the 70s, when we sort of started tracking these things, has increased pretty dramatically from the low single digits and now almost 20%. And it's expected that it'll be somewhere around 30% in the near future that are women who serve. And so the recognition on the part of my staff member was that there had never been a caucus that was focused exclusively on women who serve. And it's not just women veterans, but also as they're recruited, you know, what are their particular needs as they come on board active duty, as they go and maybe transition into reserve status, as they go into their veterans part of their career. Those are all parts of the arc of a woman who serves. And the Women's Caucus, you don't have to be a woman, you don't have to be a veteran, you don't have to be on armed services or foreign affairs or veterans affairs or any of those kind of sweet spots for this population to be worried and concerned about whether or not we're taking care of our women who serve.
What's the biggest issue that has come up or you expect to come up?
Well, I think there are going to be a lot of issues. They're going to range anywhere from, for instance, me. I was active duty in the late 80s and early 90s, and I had my first child when I was active duty. And the base had a 6-month waiting list for childcare, and I had 6 weeks of leave. And so that was one of the things that precipitated my leaving the military, was that I couldn't afford childcare outside, you know, on the outside economy. I was stationed in Boston, which is a very expensive place to live. And so issues of childcare, issues of family, you know, life balance, issues of healthcare for the veteran or for the active duty woman. How do you make sure that you're tending to the trailing spouse? There's so many different issues that women will have as they serve that there, I don't think that I could necessarily identify one or the other. I can say, however, that one of the issues that we've already been tackling is that as women are transitioning from active duty into being veterans, they largely don't feel as though the VA is for them. And there has been a really successful pilot program in the Air Force where they have identified that that's a problem. And by educating women as they're transitioning out, by giving them just 4 hours of training about the VA and what it can do for you, they're seeing remarkable decreases in the likelihood of suicide. They're seeing remarkable increases in the likelihood that women will access the VA. And so this program that was existing in the Air Force, we've asked now for it to be replicated in the Army and in the Navy as well. And so that's another example of something that this caucus can do.
There's only 4 women veterans in office, and that obviously does not compare to the scale of the number of women who are now in the military. Why do you think there have been so few women that have served who then wanted to come and run for Congress or serve in Congress?
So it's actually kind of not just about women, and it's also about sort of men as well who have served. It's hard to be a veteran and to think of yourself in this seat. And I think that there's a lot of reasons why that's the case. People in their community are used to thinking about them as effectively being carpetbaggers in a way. And that's kind of the attack that naturally will come at a veteran is, well, you don't live here. You haven't lived here in a while. And that's really unfortunate. The other reason why I think you see fewer veterans than you should is that, of course, we don't have enormous networks of people who have resources. And, you know, when you're an early stage candidate, access to capital is part of the way that you can communicate your message. And we just don't have the networks that everybody has. So I don't think it's just women veterans that the problem is. I think it's, you know, kind of all of us.
Well, I want to take a step back. You grew up in a military family. What did your parents do?
So my dad was a P-3 pilot, which is an anti-submarine aircraft, and it's land-based. My grandfather was also a P-3 and a P-2 pilot, and my dad actually met my mom because my grandfather was his skipper, so he was the commander of my dad's squadron. And my dad and my mom married when my mom was 19, so it's been a very successful and long marriage. My mom and my grandmother were both effectively career Navy wives, and that was and still is, you know, an important aspect of how you serve. I actually just visited my grandparents' grave today at Arlington, and my grandmother is buried with my grandfather, and it's her career as well.
You moved around a lot as a child. We were just talking about that, just the kind of the nature of service and being deployed in different bases, in different areas. I read that you were also really shy. That seems like it would be a hard combo.
I am really shy. And I am kind of an introverted person. And I think that moving around every year kind of either makes you or breaks you. It creates the opportunity for you to see all the different parts of our country and realize that we're all different but the same. I have been to a lot of places and seen a lot of things, and I do know what our country looks like from the outside in. But you're right, moving every single year, having to get a new set of classmates every single year is a challenge was a challenge for me. And in fact, as a consequence, I really wanted to make sure I raised my kids in one place. And so I've been in Chester County for 25 years. I wanted to make sure my kids had the chance to be in one school, and I succeeded in that. So I'm very grateful that I had a chance to raise my kids in one place.
And as a girl, you wanted to become an astronaut, which for a long time obviously was not an option for women. What made you believe you could do that?
So I actually saw, and this is important to the conversation that we were having about seeing, you know, women or veterans in Congress. I saw Sally Ride, you know, and I saw that she did it. And I saw that she was a physicist and that she went to Stanford. And so I wanted to go to Stanford, and I got in and I got an ROTC scholarship. And I also saw that a lot of people who were successful astronauts were pilots. And so I thought that if I went into the Air Force, there were more pilots in the Air Force than in the Navy, which is my family's tradition. And that was probably a good place to start. And that there were more women in the Air Force than there were in the Navy, even though the Navy is, you know, one of my favorite services. And so that's what my journey was, is to say, I'm going to go to the school where the astronaut went. I'm going to major in something that's science-y, and I'm going to be a pilot.
So you plotted your course. You were in the ROTC at Stanford. And in 1985, when you arrived in Palo Alto, the ROTC wasn't welcome on campus. Talk about that.
It actually was a big disappointment to me, and it made it a lot harder to stay in ROTC because I started with a class of 40 at Stanford freshmen. Mm-hmm. By the time we graduated, 4 of us went out the other end. And that was largely because ROTC wasn't welcome at Stanford's campus. We actually ended up commuting to San Jose State University, which is where Air Force ROTC was. And in order to do that, basically all of Friday was committed to ROTC at San Jose State. And that meant that most of my classes, I was an engineer, were Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And that meant that I would literally miss, had to miss a third of all my classes to be able to be in ROTC. And that definitely was daunting for an engineer to be expected to miss that many of her classes. And so what I can tell you now is my youngest daughter actually also went to Stanford, just graduated 2 years ago. And Stanford now does have ROTC on campus, and it seems to be a thriving area. And in fact, my daughter majored in political science and international relations, and many of the people who are in ROTC and also who are active duty and doing graduate work are involved in that department.
How did you get comfortable when you kind of face those moments of adversity and being yourself, pursuing your ambitions, which were clearly maybe not in line with a lot of what your peers were believed?
I think that you just have to kind of believe in yourself. One of the things that when I decided to run for office that I didn't think twice about, honestly, was just raising my hand. You know, when I thought hard about where we were as a nation and how concerned I was about the democracy and what was happening to the tone and tenor of our country. And I thought about all of the experiences that I had, you know, whether it was serving in the military or growing businesses, or I was also an educator. I taught through Teach for America. I felt like I had all of the right experiences to be able to be here and to be of service here. And so I, you know, raised my hand. And so I think that I've never really thought about what other people will think about, you know, my decisions. Mm-hmm. And I also really never thought that there was anything wrong with completely changing and transitioning to something that has nothing to do with something you've already done before. So this just seemed like another great opportunity to take my skills somewhere else.
You got an offer from the Air Force for a spot training as a pilot, which is a very competitive process, but you decided to turn it down.
So I did. And I did that because having grown up in the military and having grown up in an aviator family, I knew what the obligation was. I knew that it was a 10-year commitment and probably a year to wait for my training. That would have been 11 years. I knew that I had already met who would then become my husband, who is now my husband of almost 30 years. And I knew that I didn't want to ask of him that trailing spouse, you know, challenge. So I thought it would be a better path for me to be an engineer, which is what I ended up doing, to serve as an engineer in the Air Force and to not necessarily have to ask of him to transition every single year.
Was it hard being, because you get married, you're both in the military, but was it hard being a mother on active duty?
So actually, my husband was not in the military. And so this is actually one of the reasons why I think that we had this childcare dilemma. The expectation was of a traditional military family would be the man would be active duty and the woman would be the trailing spouse and the woman would be responsible for childcare and for transitioning the family from place to place. And so, no, I mean, we didn't serve at the same time. I think he had never even known anybody who had worn a uniform before. And so we were kind of a unique couple in that way.
So you made the choice to leave based on the childcare issue?
Partly, you know, partly it was because of that. Actually, another interesting fact is that I had gotten admitted to graduate school and I went to the Air Force and said, I've gotten into graduate school. Would you, you know, be able to help me go? And they said, yes, but we would like you to go to Ohio to go to graduate school. And I said, but I got into graduate school in Boston. You know, this is where my husband lives. This is, you know, where my life is. And that was another kind of like when the military said that, yes, you can, but you have to go to Ohio. That was another indicator for me that this wasn't necessarily a good combination.
Was it hard given your family history to say, all right, I'm going to choose a new path?
You know, my family's always been enormously forgiving of that kind of kind of transition. I think what was harder was where we ended up going as a family was my husband and I ended up joining a friend who had started a t-shirt company and telling your parents that you're leaving the military and going to join a t-shirt company was a little bit of a hard swallow for my parents. And in the end, that organization ended up becoming a really successful apparel and footwear company. I think it was a good choice.
Well, before we leave your military service, I want to ask you a little bit about the fact that your experience as being a female in a very male-dominated industry, mm-hmm. versus the military, pilot, studying engineering, technology. You pursued all of those things. As a young woman, were you aware of the sort of gendered expectations, and how did you deal with it?
So the company, that the t-shirt company, was actually a basketball apparel and footwear company. So it was very, very male dominated and I didn't play basketball. I am always aware of the fact that I am one of few. You know, I am 10% of my graduating classes at Stanford were women. Very few women were in the Air Force with me. Very few women were in a basketball company with me. But I don't sort of walk into the room and think, huh, you know, I'm the only woman here. I don't necessarily think about it every day.
Did you face, you know, issues where maybe you weren't promoted or you, because you were a woman, or harassment, things that so many women face in the workforce?
You know, I think the things that you face are even small things. When somebody walks into the room and doesn't introduce themselves to you and you don't appear to even be there, you know, right. That's a very small thing, but you notice it. You know, when my very first briefing as a lieutenant was to a general officer, you know, a general, and my colonel introduced me with a blonde joke. And I thought, you know, that's not exactly the way that I wanted to start this briefing. Right. I really would have liked to have had the opportunity to just be a lieutenant. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there's always this sort of small things that you notice, and sometimes larger things as well.
Any advice for women who are going through that in their own career?
It's interesting because I have three grown daughters. And I think that my advice to them is always just to, you know, load yourself up with every asset that you can. You know, there, something like education is an example. We've talked a lot about that. Something you cannot take away from me that has nothing to do with my gender. And, you know, being ready, being prepared, and having all of the arsenal that you need to make sure that you are equal is important. And that would be my advice.
A lot of folks who leave the military kind of end up in the defense world. You did not. You, as you said, you went into the kind of sporting goods, you know, kind of startup world. You've done a lot of different businesses. Why was that a better fit for you?
Well, and one of the reasons we didn't talk about that I was compelled to separate from the military was, of course, the childcare issue, the graduate school issue. But also I saw the path, right? The path was 25, 30 years before I would be that general officer, hopefully. I served in the late 80s and 90s, and not every field was available to women at that time. So the likelihood that I would be that general officer was limited as well. And I believed in myself, and I believed that I had the ability to lead, and I was impatient. And so I wanted to, you know, step out and do something that was uncomfortable. And entrepreneurship is absolutely that, you know, you can only blame yourself if it doesn't work. And so I had the chance to step out and try to be a general as quickly as possible.
You also had another twist in your career. You joined Teach for America and became a high school chemistry teacher for a year. How did being a teacher change your perspective?
So of all the things I've ever done, including this job, that was the hardest thing that I've ever done, is to be a high school chemistry teacher. And I taught in a community that was incredibly challenged. The kids there were remarkable kids, but they were living under very, very difficult circumstances, where food scarcity was an issue, where violence was an issue, where mental health was an issue, where the education opportunities were nowhere near the kind of opportunities my children had. I taught chemistry at the same time my youngest child was taking chemistry. And so 10 miles away, you know, seeing the tragic difference in the way that we expect to educate kids was an incredible eye opener. And the reason I did teach is that I wanted to take my business background into education. And I felt like I had some really good skills in growing businesses and being helpful on the operations side. But if I wanted to be helpful in education, I needed to first see what it was like. And what I saw was, boy, those kids are, you know, everything is a challenge. And it's impossible to teach a child chemistry if they are reading at the third or fourth grade level. And it is also impossible for them, therefore, to be expected to get out of high school and have any sort of job of any consequence if they don't have literacy skills, if they don't have basic math skills. And so that's effectively what I learned. What I also learned is that it's all on the teacher. The weight of the world is on the teacher and the four walls in her classroom, and that we really don't treat our teachers properly. We don't compensate them properly. We don't honor them correctly. And it's the hardest job I've ever done.
I want to shift gears a little bit to politics before we run out of time. When did you decide to run for Congress?
There were a couple of moments. You know, I decided the election of 2016 was a real wake-up call for me. I really didn't understand why we as a nation made the decision that we did in 2016 for president. I clearly missed something. I had kind of knocked doors for president for Hillary Clinton and sat with my oldest daughter to watch the election results and thought that we were going to see history made. And it didn't happen. And I was so concerned about for my daughter, who's a member of the LGBTQ community, for my dad, who's a survivor of the Holocaust. You know, those were people in my life who were very unnerved by the choices that we had just made. And so part of my decision process was, how can I be helpful? You know, how can I heal the country? How can I bring order back? And part of the journey was to think, well, what can I do to help? Well, I have these skills, you know, of serving in one form or another and educating and building. And I think those are the things we need right now. And so that was part of my process. The other way that I decided to run is I reached out to anybody who would listen. You know, I contacted my local, I'm a Democrat, so I contacted my local Democratic community, whom I had only knocked doors for in the past, hadn't really any real relationship with. And I literally also hit reply to an email that Emily's List sends me every hour, it seems, you know, for a dollar or $2, and just attached my resume and said I'd be interested in running for Congress. And they wrote me back.
It's so interesting because so often in this, on this podcast, we talk about women and how they have to be asked many times. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, I think it's three or four times before they will take the leap to run for any kind of at any level. But you kind of had the reverse situation where you were really motivated. Were you intimidated at all by the process and what you kind of were undertaking, or maybe you just didn't know everything that was going to go into it?
So the ironic thing is that a lot of the people that I've worked with over the last 25 years are my friends from college, mm-hmm. you know, and they're mostly men. In fact, they're all men, and they get together regularly and talk about stuff. And I tend to be there, too, because I'm one of the posse. They collectively would talk to each other all the time about who's going to run for office. And they'd talk around me. You know, I was almost not there. Mm-hmm. And I would think, I wonder why nobody's looking at me. I never wanted to run for office. It wasn't like I was like, oh, why not me? Mm-hmm. But when it came time for this time, it was my time. I had to do this. And so I did do a lot of research. I'm an engineer. You know, I took right. 3 or 4 months of talking to people and analyzing the likelihood and understanding the job. And I'm also an entrepreneur. I'm very comfortable with chaos. And I'm really comfortable with, you know, uncertainty. And so I think that I didn't need to be asked this time. I would have appreciated being included in the conversation other times.
Were those guys supportive of your run?
Oh, very. Yeah. I mean, I think they're all kind of stunned, honestly. but they were very, very supportive. Yeah.
We'll talk about that because one of the other big hurdles for women is fundraising. You raise a lot of money for your first campaign. How did you make it look so easy?
It was super hard. It was every bit of every minute of every day for 2 years. And I am a vet and I'm an engineer and I'm an introvert. And so all of those things were, you know, conspiring against me to do the things that needed to be done, to find a network that didn't exist, you know, to ask for things that made me uncomfortable to ask for. But it had to be done. And I think one of the ways that I did that was understanding and studying how people do it successfully. But another way that I was successful is I found other women, you know, who were running and who were similarly motivated. And what we discovered is that we were told that this is an island, that you are an island as a candidate and that you shouldn't share anything, no resources, no ideas, no anything. That's how we run. And we discovered as neophytes and women is that didn't have to be the way it went. So we shared, you know, we did things together. We did fundraisers together. We shared donors together, you know, and we innovated on how it's done.
Who were the other women?
So the other women are the women of service. Mm-hmm. You know, they're the women who either are Navy vets. We have some CIA and me. And there were, you know, sadly, several who didn't make it through. And many are running again. And so we've got kind of a team. And now we've showed people it can be done.
I have one last question for you. When you ran for Congress, you said that if elected, you hoped that in D.C. you'd find, quote, a lot of people who want to be part of a wave of change. Now that you've been in the job for 5 months, are you still feeling so optimistic?
So it's you hit me on probably a bad day for that, the answer to that question. But I think that largely, yes, you know, we are a class of 63 Democratic freshmen, a couple dozen Republican freshmen, together collectively, we are a lot of Congress, you know, absolutely. And that is a lot of opportunity for change and for fresh ideas. And so I think we are challenging the status quo and we're challenging the way it's always been done. It's a very, very old institution. And I think change is very, very hard in older institutions, particularly ones that are not hierarchical, but are really dispersed the way that this one is. You know, there's 435 independent contractors here, and to ask for everybody to change without some sort of top down, you know, thing is hard. So I am still optimistic that the fact that we're here is making a difference, but I do know I see a little bit of why this is so hard to turn this ship.
It's got to be tough as an entrepreneur. We're used to, you know, smaller organizations being nimble, having to change on a dime.
It is really tough to see what is obvious, you know, easy, you know, low hanging fruit not be possible. And one example I'll give you is I'm on five subcommittees, and at any one point in time, sometimes all three of them are meeting at the same time. Right. You know, my high school kids know how to rotate classes better than Congress does. You know, we know how to block schedule. And we can figure this out. You know, we can figure out how to make the votes at the right time, and we can figure out how to have it so that we're not finding ourselves coming and going. This is not a technical problem. You know, this right. is just a organizational issue.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Women Rule is produced by Zach Stanton. Our booker is Jessica Andrews. Dave Shaw is the executive producer of Politico Audio. A special thanks to Jenny Amont for helping us with this recording. The show is made in partnership with our founding partners, Google and the Tory Burch Foundation. If you're a fan of the show, please subscribe to Women Rule on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us and leave a review. And please share your episodes on social media and follow me on Twitter and Instagram at @apalmerdc. You can also join the Women Rule community by texting WOMEN to 66866.